So, hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And today we've entitled it Trade War Explodes, in light, I guess, of the continuing topic and theme, I guess, in view of the Chinese and US relations recently raising tariffs, the US into Chinese tariffs of 10 to 25%. We've had an ongoing issue with Huawei versus Apple. Interesting to see how that plays out. And of course, as it all seems to be a little bit of a matinee into the G20 summit in Osaka later on next month. So we'll jump into it. First, I'll introduce, as always, our panel. So we've got our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. G'day, David.
Hi, Tim.
And we have Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
So let's move into the agenda for today. So we're going to begin by, a bit of a recap and looking at Cold War 2.0, looking at some US goals, how these will play out, and then, as always, reflect this back into the investment impacts, both from a view of asset allocation, but also stock selection on how we invest money every day here at Nucleus Wealth and at the MB Fund. So with no further ado, let's jump into it. A little bit of background, gentlemen. Who would like to begin? Damien.
Yeah, look, so we've done this, this is our third go at this, the trade war, and so what we're going to run through a bit today is what we thought was going to happen, and where we are. We sort of had a list of different scenarios that could play out. So one of them was sort of a quick resolution, and that one's obviously been crossed off, and so we're working our way down the severity of the issues with the trade war. But to start with, we just wanted to give that background from where, how did we get to where we are today? Because it is important to recognize that what are the key drivers behind this? This isn't sort of a short-term transactional, we don't believe it's a short-term transactional thing from the US in terms of just, you know, something to appease the Trump space and he'll move on to the next shiny object. We do think there are bigger issues. And so it pretty much, I mean, you go right back to the start of China coming into the world trade back sort of in the 90s. Sorry.
WTO.
Yes, sorry. Back in the they made a number of promises as to things they were going to do, and not all those promises have been sort of fulfilled. And recently, China came out with a 2025 where they're looking to move up the value chain in a whole range of different technological areas. So whereas before they'd sort of mainly done the dumb manufacturing and the low cost manufacturing, now sort of they unveiled this sort of plan to go really move up the scale. And at the same time, they'd been, you know, doing some things in islands in the South China Sea and other stuff like that. And so what we saw was that Bannon came out in particular as very much China hawk. Pence had a speech, and he's sort of been quite he's given quite a decent look into the whole scenario, and his sort of view, which does seem to permeate through Trump's agenda, is that US transferred a lot of technology, a lot of manufacturing across to China, which lowered prices, which was great for Chinese consumers, but it put a whole bunch of workers out of jobs right throughout the middle America, and they haven't got a solution for these guys as to where they're going to go, and that that the US has given up, is basically given way to the lower socioeconomic classes have borne all the pain of the rise in China. So it's sort of been an equal rise. Mm. It's really helped the elites in terms of the US and the Wall Street and companies and the sort of higher echelons. But it hasn't helped the and it's basically been detrimental to the average man in the street. And so then Pence came out with a speech mid last year that very much laid out a whole bunch of sort of a pathway and all the problems and all the issues that they saw in terms of the Chinese rise and where China had sort of promised to do things and to reform but had sort of started down the path and then backtracked a little bit and never sort of fulfilled on the promises. So for us, you know, it's not, as I said, a single transactional issue. There is some quite it's been quite built up in terms of background, and it goes a lot deeper. The Democrats are largely on board with most of it as well. Like we expect that, you know, you would have got a similar thing if you had seen a President Bernie Sanders. You would have got a similar outlook, but he would have been a lot nicer to our allies, to sort of US allies. But you know, that idea about sort of not letting China
hollow out the manufacturing.
Exactly. Yeah. Sort of, it's not as much about, you know, there are parts about, you know, it's not just a hubris, we can't let China be a competitor to us. It's, I think they're generally happy for China to rise, but not at the expense of other countries.
Mm.
And also they need to, you know, if they want to be open access to markets, then they need to reciprocate, and they can't be, you know, you can't run a communist totalitarian society that doesn't let other people invest or things like that in yours and expect open markets elsewhere.
Okay.
Then we saw this this real push as well in terms of media releases that came out in terms of the number of hacking issues, spy chips on computer hardware, and just this whole push about the problems behind if you let a totalitarian society start to move up that value chain, and you start to give them access to these higher levels, and that China, and I guess then throwing out evidence that China had broken the trust in terms of what they were doing. Now the chances are, you know, there are other people doing the same from other countries, and there's always lots of stuff going on in the spy world you never hear about, but there certainly seems to be a very concerted push to release this stuff publicly. And to sort of, I guess, scare off and make companies think twice about, right, I was going to do all this stuff in China. Okay, now I need to really think about, do I want to, you know, maybe I just do the, I keep doing the dumb stuff in China, but I don't step up the value chain. And I actually make sure that's part of my strategy is to not let these things stack up. So, you know, and the thoughts behind that is that tariffs are really just the beginning of this. So partly it's about tariffs, but it's actually about a broader on a whole bunch of different levels. And China's obviously got its Belt and Road strategy, where it's going out and trying to push infrastructure and loans upon a whole bunch of countries to try and, I guess, help its soft power as well. And again, the US, there's a pushback in terms of the US and from that.
Mm.
But David, have you got anything I missed?
No, that's a pretty good background. We could swing over to that next slide. And you've started to kind of tip into the US goals there already, which is, you know, we kind of started with fairness in trade, but, you know, it's, I guess you could say there's a bit of a continuum here between fairness in trade, tariffs, et cetera, and a deal on one end, and on the other end is Chinese containment.
Mm.
That is the US preventing China's rise for, you know, in geopolitical terms, to more or less sustain its sphere of influence. So you, on that continuum, we're kind of now shifting day to day, and definitely pushing away from a simple trade deal towards something much more comprehensive in terms of the US taking on China. Steve Bannon, who's, you know, the former chief strategist in the White House and is now, you know, sort of the global spearhead for the intellectual narrative around this,
mm-hmm.
at least from the US side, you know, has been running as a kind of outrider for the White House in the global press, and he's banging on, you know, very much along the lines of a kind of US total economic war versus a, you know, as a kind of response to China's comprehensive economic war. He basically represents China's rise as an economic war. I don't agree with that entirely, but there are certainly dimensions to Chinese participation in the global trading system that needed to be addressed. You know, I mean, the forced technology transfers, etc., were pretty egregious, and it's got lots of behind the border protections, etc. So, you know, there's this whole kind of spectrum of issues that the US is now raising, you know, from tech leadership to this, you know, generalized move up the value chain, which would, you know, if the US can prevent it, it kind of traps China in the middle income trap, it's called,
mm-hmm.
by development economists. which itself is part of China's catch-up growth, which where it's had this speedy growth model driven by investment, which in turn, you know, kind of leads to military power over you know, decadal timeframes. And so all of these things are starting to come together, you know, as a single narrative in the US, not entirely, but certainly kind of semi-converging that way. And so, you know, you can't really say at this point that the US goal is explicitly China's containment, but that rhetoric has actually started to appear in the last week for the first time, really, from President Trump, who's been saying we're simply not going to let China catch up. It's not going to overtake us, and we're going to stay top dog, which is something new, although it was kind of hinted at previously by Vice President Mike Pence when he sort of declared this Cold War 2.0 framework. So US goals, I mean, wrapping up that slide, I guess US goals at this point are unclear, but on that continuum of trade tariffs versus Chinese containment, at the moment we're definitely accelerating towards containment.
Okay.
Which is obviously a worry in terms of how this transpires for trade, geopolitics, and economic growth and investments.
Well, that's a good point to jump across to how it might all play out.
So, yes, how might it play out? Well, obviously there are multiple spear tips here, many of them, most of them being thrown by the US, some of them now being thrown back by China. We started, of course, with our tit-for-tat for tariffs, which we've had several rounds now from the US and several rounds from China. Of course, China cannot win in a tariff battle. Simply by definition, as the surplus country, it's going to lose more than it gains.
And so what David means by that is that if you're somebody selling to, you know, we have US wants to buy goods, and we're selling it to them, but not taking much back from the US. Is if the US starts to put up taxes on specifically from China, then other countries all of a sudden become much more competitive relative to China. So as much as China can say, oh, you know, we're going to boycott this and boycott that, the trade coming back the other way is nowhere near as large. And so there's nowhere near the potential for them to harm the US in terms of, terms of that. So the US is, you know, the harm to the US is basically that they have some higher prices, but they won't be the full amount of higher prices because there will be substitution off to other countries. But China loses out, you know, twice in that they have reduced demand for ones they where the US can't shift, and then also they lose demand to other countries that can supply it without tariffs.
That's right. So, I mean, the US will be a marginal gainer, but a lot of other low-cost jurisdictions will certainly benefit. So our second spear tip is Huawei, which Australia has been intimately involved in generating this one. And this is turning very hot indeed. You know, there are the US is basically on a global PR campaign to lock Huawei out of 5G, which is the next generation telco CapEx wave. Mm-hmm. And that's also starting to tip into bans for US firms to actually do business with Huawei, and so you know, some of the US suppliers into Huawei products are already talking about no longer being able to do business.
For example, Google's talked about not being able to send out Android updates anymore to their phones.
Yeah, yep. So I mean, this is a very big deal. Huawei's major national champion tech leader in China and globally. It and ZTE are, you know, like the two large telco tech firms, basically, for infrastructure. And, you know, they're going to get locked out, certainly locked out in the US, very, very much so here. Australia played an integral part in the Huawei pushback. Australian spooks were feeding a lot of intelligence into Washington. Europe looks like it's more or less on board, although they're kind of doing, you know, kind of trying to play both sides against the middle.
But the effect anyway is that if you're a big European company or a big multinational headquartered in Europe and US has banned it, Australia's banned it, you know, UK's banned it or whatever, you're going to, you're going to have to get a really great value proposition to go with Huawei. You know, if you've got a choice between anyone else paying a bit more, you'll just pay a bit more. And just
on that note, I guess, talking about sort of Australia's influence somewhat into Washington and the Huawei sort of ongoing saga, the flip side of that is that, you know, obviously there's a side being taken there. And do you think there's a retaliatory tariff? And maybe we'll cross a little bit more of this in the investment piece, but in terms of, you know, obviously Australia is a major export partner.
Absolutely. We're already seeing it.
Yep.
We've seen it in coal. Although you know they tend to do it in a disguised way. I mean, nobody comes out and says you're going to cop this, but if your coal's just turned away from ports, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Agricultural products is usually where they do it because they just say, "Oh, there's some vague disease somewhere, and so we can't have any of your stuff anymore."
Milk powder, it's on the nose. Ours is better.
The other one is highly speculative, but the there's a big topping out in Chinese tourism and students in Australia over the last 6 to 9 months that does coincide with the deterioration in relations. You could just say that that's market forces. It may well be.
Mm.
But let's just say there's a correlation there. May not be causation, but, you know, we could note it.
Mm, sure.
So all of this, comes back to this point that Damo made about global supply chain shift, which doesn't require any of this to actually become concrete. It's already happening. You know, simply the risk of these things happening as they develop and increase in intensity can, you know, obviously draws into question further investment by US firms in China. And
so one of the real benefits of China at the moment is that, you know, and Apple is a good example of somebody who uses China, you know, and was looking to transfer parts back to the US, and that, you know, they couldn't find the screw provider that they needed to, you know, and so the big benefit of China is you've got everything really close, and all these different suppliers all sort of interact with each other, and the whole network's quite close. Now I think what companies are doing is saying, well, I can't rely on that. That's always going to be there for me, and so I need to spread out, and I need to work out, how do I have screw providers in multiple countries, and how do I, you know, this, if I lose this or I lose that in China or whatever, I need to have contingency plans in place.
Mm.
Whereas I think before a lot of it was just I want the lowest cost possible cost. And if that means it's push it all into China, whereas now it's saying, well, I need these contingency plans and it needs to be shifted away from being China-centric.
So survey in the FT this morning from, I think, the American Chamber of Commerce, something like half US corporations that are in China are diversifying their investment away or pulling out.
Mm-hmm. And China was getting more expensive as well. Mm-hmm. So part of this is that it is cheaper to manufacture in a number of other countries around. But China, because China was very convenient because it had everything there.
Yep.
And so now if you're saying, okay, not only are prices a lot more expensive than 10 years ago, but also we've got these geopolitical issues. Okay, there is now, I wasn't going to do it just for cost because it's a hassle, but now I need to start considering doing it.
Yeah, sure.
So China is not without options and has taken a few in response to all of this reprisal. As we know, they've put tariffs of their own on. The one that's probably of most interest to Australia is LNG.
Mm.
I think that's now up to 25%, which is going to start, well, basically has priced US gas out of China.
Chinese might almost start paying more for gas than we do.
that'll be a first. So we might end up with more gas business out of that. But then that raises a really tricky question for us in terms of further gas investment, at least. If you can draw the dots at a certain point and see a US gas project not go ahead and a comparable one go ahead in Australia, you know, then it's going to throw up all sorts of really tricky questions for the US alliance. It's very different to just a market operating. I mean, you've got, you know, Trump is an oil and gas man. If Australia starts stealing US gas business because of Trump's trade war, I don't think that's going to help the alliance much.
Yeah. I'd argue though on the energy front that it's pretty transferable in terms of energy. That
it is. It's fungible, yeah. So yeah,
there's 10 different ships sailing out, 5 from Australia, 5 from the US. If China wants 5.
Yeah.
And they won't take the US ones. And all 5 of the Australian ones end up there, and the 5 US spread out to South Korea and Japan and a few other places. Yeah. Whereas if it's an equal footing, then half the Australian ships end up one place. And
US gas is more competitive in Europe anyway, simply because it's got it doesn't have to sail through the Panama Canal, etc. So yes, it is quite fungible, so that might not be too much of a problem. But so they've had their what tariffs they can do. There's this current sort of brouhaha around rare earths, because Xi Jinping, which is, these sort of highly rare and useful metals that are used particularly in tech and defense.
And I'll push back on the word rare, though. They're actually not that rare. Yeah. Like,
they're not rare at all.
No, there's lots of them out there. What's rare is a country that's willing to put up with the amount of crap that comes out of these processing plants.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Which is why you see this big thing in Malaysia at the moment with Linus, and they're pushing back about saying, we don't want this thing sitting in our backyard.
Yeah,
and
right.
So why China's got so much of the rare earths at the moment is because they've been willing to take the environmental pain of processing these things.
Mm, yeah. Okay.
And so,
if you look at the history of rare earth production, it's like 90% US just collapsing over the last 10 to 15 years, as the developed economies get more sensitive about the environment and all of it swinging to China. But it can clearly swing back if it needs to.
Mm.
Yeah. In a strategic sense, like if it becomes a defence imperative, then they just reopen some mines. So it's all a bit of a furphy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, there could very well be a short-term shock. Like if China just said, that's it, we're closing the door, no more ships sailing out of here with rare earths on them, there would be a huge shock for 6 to 12 months while everyone scrambles madly to try and get these things up. But in 5 years' time, you'd be back to this.
Yep.
If I may say so, I think it would probably be the stupidest thing that China's ever done, because they're the big commodity importer, not the US. Yeah. And, they can counter on so many fronts if they do rare earths that it's not funny, leaving China short of all sorts of crippled commodities.
Yep.
And that would obviously be a nightmare scenario for Australia. If Washington starts leaning on us to inhibit iron ore or coal exports, which, is getting pretty, pretty extreme. And it does, though, I think, the implicit threat of the rare earths is probably best viewed as the extent of Chinese anger and desperation. Because to be stuffing around with commodity supply is really, serious stuff.
Yep.
In terms of diplomacy and free markets. Well,
wanting to be, I would like to be a global player, and I don't want everyone to trade fairly with me, but I'm just going to hold up this thing and stuff the rest of the world economy. So, but now I want you to come back and start dealing fair and openly with me.
It's pretty irrational.
Yeah.
I've got a question just before we roll into the final one there. Is there a possibility for the world to move to full protectionism and only international trade between certain blocks to being goods and services that the other side cannot acquire, mainly perhaps natural resources? A total breakdown of international law regarding intellectual property rights, pseudo-Cold War. If yes, what will it take for such scenario to play out? Thank you, Nick.
I think it's certainly possible that we see trading blocks emerge across the sort of hegemonic footprints of the US and China.
Mm.
You'll see, for instance, the Chinese tech firms will be very busy in Iran, but not doing much anywhere else. In that broad sense, yes, I think that's plausible. I don't think you reach the point of commodity blockades easily. Yeah. Like, that's the stuff of wars. Shooting wars.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, that's what transpired prior to World War II between the US and Japan. Everybody probably recalls Pig Iron Bob. When Australian wharfies started to boycott sending Australian steel to Japan in the lead up to World War II, and Bob Menzies at the time continued the shipments, and it was very, very controversial. I think he was it wasn't PM at the time. He was the head of the legal, the law talking guy, and so. That stuff is real kind of end of days.
Mm.
So, I mean, if we do get there, then we all need to be very frightened. That's why I think the rare earths play by China, as sort of underhanded as it's been, or surreptitious, I should say, is just really lunatic.
Yeah, it's been much more of an implied threat, though, as well.
It is. That's what I mean by surreptitious. It's not an actual threat, but they must be aware that they're sending a signal, and it's a crazy signal to send.
Yeah.
So, yes, on the trading blocks scenario. In fact, I think that's the explicit US goal, is to lock China out of the global trading system on certain levels. And China's clearly going to respond by trying to do the same to the US across its alliance network. It's just much smaller and much less developed. So hopefully we don't reach the point where it becomes commodity based, because at that point, as I say, all bets are off. And so this brings us to the China's last kind of weapon, and that is a weaponized yuan. You don't really have to even see this as a weapon. I think this is kind of inevitable. As Chinese manufacturing takes this on the chin, it's struggling to reflate its broader economy, simply because it's doing so much building already. And we all know about its structural debt problems longer term. It doesn't want to have to go that way, because that way also lies further stagnation and middle income trap. And so at a certain point, it's probably going to have to cut interest rates, at which point, yuan devaluation becomes a market play. It's just market forces at work. To me, there is a certain inevitability to that.
And why David's saying it's weaponized, what he's talking about here is that they're forcing the currency down, which means US put a 20% tariff on everything. Decrease your currency by 20%, and so locals are still getting it's obviously it's not quite normal, because it's not normal, but you can still keep your manufacturing going.
Yeah, sure.
You don't lose your manufacturing out, but you still lose out in terms of anything you want to buy from overseas or send people overseas or whatever. You lose out on that front. But
there's a further risk that comes with that. There are a whole bunch of risks that come with that, actually, but we'll probably come back to those into the next slide. Slide?
Before we go, though, I just wanted to say that there is a bit of a comment. You see comments around saying, China's got all these US treasuries and all this, US debt. They can just get rid of all their US debt, and that'll crash the US economy if they wanted to. That'd crash the Chinese economy as well.
Yep.
But then whether it would crash the US economy is very much in doubt, because quite possibly under a sort of weaponized debt scenario, the US Fed just steps in and says, okay, well, I'll just buy whatever China's got to sell.
We'll
just transfer it from the Chinese central bank to the US central bank, and let's just keep going.
Don't think that would even be necessary. If the China starts selling treasuries en masse as a strategic play, then I think you'd see capital outflow out of China accelerate. And the entire emerging markets kind of complex meltdown. You'll see just a massive bond bid everywhere. And the private sector will just buy the Chinese debt, like on the panic. I think that's just a total non-entity.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you see that anywhere, we don't think that's a...
It's not going to happen.
No.
Or if it does happen, there's not a big issue for the US.
Okay, sure thing. So we'll roll across to economic fallout.
Yeah, so as we were just sort of getting into, slower Chinese growth, most certainly in the manufacturing sector, and for Australia that's not irrelevant to bulk commodity demand. It's probably, in total 20 or 25% of metal consumption. We'll see some stimulus, of course, already started. But there's difficulties on this front already. We've seen them try to inject a lot of money without cutting interest rates, and they have succeeded to some extent. But as we've said a myriad times, the floor space under construction in China today has never been higher. It's already at extreme levels, and getting it higher is just no mean feat. If you're building in Germany every year, then to grow the following year, and you're going to build Germany and France, is really tough. So no doubt they'll have to try, but you know, there's also a secondary issue here, which is a lot of the real estate developers in China rely on US dollar funding, and with the higher US dollar and the potentially at the moment falling Chinese yuan and potentially falling further, you know, that's a difficulty as well. So some Chinese stimulus, yes, but difficulties with it as well. So, you know, as we've said, these shifting supply chains, in particular, we're going to see low-cost countries benefit, thinking, you know, your Vietnam sort of slash Mexico style countries, smaller emerging markets with low labor costs that exist, I think, importantly, within the US alliance network. So perhaps rather than Vietnam, somewhere like Thailand. You know, that so committed US allies that you can, you know, rely on over a longer term to be to not face the trade war risks if you're shifting your production. Higher US inflation in the short term, that's just a tariff story.
Yeah, and that would be very much a look through for the central bank. So
it would,
If you're getting jumps in inflation because tariffs have all jumped up, then it's not something you're suddenly going to be raising rates and saying, you know, the economy's going too fast, we need to slow it down.
Just a quick one on the tariffs as well. So obviously with the US boost from 15% to 25%, so, you know, double and a bit, it would appear that the US would wear that for the short term. Would that be right, until demand falls? Would I have that right? So let's say a US importer bringing in Chinese exports, suddenly the tariffs go up. I'd assume that those
consumer pays for it.
The tax man, the tax effectively comes from the US back into the US back pocket.
But when you go from 10% to 25%, what happens is some of it will still come from China, but the, you know, it might be South Korea might have been 15% more expensive than China.
Yeah, sure.
And so people were still getting things from China, and then they go, okay, well, now I can just switch and get it from so I'm still paying more than I would have paid if there was no tariffs, but it's not as much as the 25%.
So there's a bit of a lead time, I guess, effectively, when they call these tariffs, because you've got the next set of orders that are going to be impacted as opposed to everything that's currently outstanding.
Yeah.
Yep, okay.
Yep. But the Damo's right that the Fed will look through that. Nonetheless, I think that we can say that this is US dollar bullish. In fact, I think all of this is kind of US dollar bullish, this entire story, at least until it reaches a point of critical mass where the global economy falls apart and the Fed's forced to come in and stimulate. That might be enough to drive the US dollar lower. But basically, the US is going to win this war. And so, you know, everyone's going to bid the US dollar higher on inflation, on repatriation of supply chains, on declining, all sorts of sort of declining Chinese power across the matrix. Europe is connected to China much more in a macro sense than the US is, so there's no bid into the euro either. There's a whole range of things that drive up the US dollar in these scenarios. And then, you know, one more that we've listed there is just more US capex at the margin. That is, some of these supply chains will come home. They'll probably be automated. There may not be a whole lot of jobs in it. But it is an opportunity to roll out automation if you're going to shift that supply chain somewhere safer in a geopolitical sense.
There's probably more jobs in the short term than there are in the long term, I guess. If you need to set up a factory with robots and all that type of stuff, it takes a lot to get it all up and running.
Absolutely.
Once you're up and running, you need a lot fewer people. But you know, there is that.
And then you've got your ongoing struggle in Europe where, you know, Europe in some ways is just a second derivative of China. Like the German economy is really, its export economy, which is central, of course, has really struggled for 12 months now because Chinese domestic demand has been waning, first on its original tightening, but now on the trade war. And a lot of that is cars and car-based. But you're just not going to get a European recovery until you get a Chinese one. And because we don't see any terrifically robust response in the Chinese domestic economy as it confronts these headwinds, then Europe's going to struggle too. So again, that's part of the overall US dollar story.
The benefit in Europe is you might get some transfer where, you know, you don't buy a Ford anymore, or you buy a BMW or whatever. Ford to BMW might be the wrong.
What about Alfa Romeo?
But yeah,
no one buys Alfa Romeos. Don't buy an Alfa Romeo.
Yeah.
So
put out a change our disclaimer there, Tim.
So we should have a look at some risk scenarios. You know, given that we've sort of brought ourselves up to speed on where we're at, this is kind of about where we're going.
Yeah. Now this, I'll about explain the first, the overall bit, and then yep. I'll let David to jump into it. This is a list, the same list we put up a couple of months ago, and a couple of months before that again. But just saying, you know, the first way out of this is a quick resolution, and that's, we've crossed that off now. It's not there. And as you go down that list, things get worse. So then you sort of step into each of the various levels until you get to the sort of real war, which we hope we never get to, but they're sort of the from the best possible solution to the worst possible solution.
Quick resolutions off the cards now. So we're into twin Keynesian booms.
Yeah, well, that's looking more like thin Keynesian booms at this point. You want to change that to an H.
Yeah, but we've added a question mark to that. Okay. Well. Yeah. That's contemplating.
I don't know. I'm just done that one off the cuff. We haven't got it wrong. The question mark is quite right. You know, like as we said, you're going to see Chinese domestic stimulus, but it's going to struggle. And the US does have a $2 trillion stimulus package kind of being mulled, but it's getting choked off in Washington. Last night, there was a big Democrats, I think Pelosi and Trump met in the Oval Office, and Trump said, yes, we'll absolutely go for a $2 trillion infrastructure stimulus so long as you leave me alone with all of these investigations. So that's not going to happen.
Our views sort of switched from what it was a few years ago, but we sort of, our views that the Democrats, it's in their best interest to go along with these big stimulus, but just delay it until to make sure that...
It happens on their watch.
Exactly. So you want to start. You probably want it to start under Trump.
Yep. Yeah.
But
the Trump response was pretty stupid, to be honest. I think it basically played into their hands.
Yeah.
So it's more kind of half a Keynesian boom on one hand and not much on the other. The U.S. economy is still going okay, domestically, anyway. Probably the big question for it is, whether just the slowing Chinese growth and its difficulty in stimulating will be enough to hold up the global economy as Europe struggles as well, and will that feed back into US earnings and crack the stock market, or it could do it via commodities, especially oil. You could see oil crack just on poor growth because there is an oil glut. One of those two things could feed back into the US stock market and actually start to take down high yield debt as well, in which case, you'd be into a kind of end of cycle shock as a part of, this sort of trade war endgame. That is the bearish case, it comes in... probably before you get to outright sanctions. I mean, even at escalating tariffs, which is where we find ourselves today, what I've just described is a quite plausible scenario. But if you get to outright sanctions, which is where China is headed, in a sort of surreptitious way, it's launching all sorts of domestic campaigns to effectively blockade US products. Boycott US products. The CPC, the Communist Party, is definitely encouraging this through the national media, I think it's also happening at the grassroots level, just out of a kind of national pride push. If that kind of gets traction, then you will see heavy damage to a lot of offshore earnings for US companies, and I think the Chinese S&P 500 will get drawn into the trade war in a negative way. We're seeing the beginnings of that now. How far does it get? Look, it's going to get worse before it gets better, because really, in terms of making the US buckle and bringing them back to the negotiating table, you need more market pain I mean, there's certainly not enough right now. They seem very happy to be running around making things worse for China for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that the stock market accident of late last year was enough to bring Trump, you know, scurrying back to the table. Will we need as much of that again to bring him back? Who knows? But, you know, I suspect if we had that kind of accident again, the global economy is much weaker now than it was then. You know, we'd be in serious trouble for a kind of global recession anyway at that point. So, you know, then we start to get it push out into, you know, kind of real kind of Cold War stuff with proxy wars, you know, where you could argue that's already transpiring in somewhere like Iran. Which is definitely part of the Chinese strategic footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got, you know, the US dispatching carrier groups over there at the moment. But also, you know, North Asia is obviously a powder keg
mm-hmm.
in this respect.
And seems to be, you know, as trade talks start to break down, then all of a sudden North Korea's out doing something to sort of to highlight that the issue again. It's just sort of saying to the US, well, come back to the negotiating table and we'll sort this out.
And or, you know, suddenly there's a false flag event in Taiwan, you know, a sudden uprising of Chinese support in some group mysteriously appears in China, and a few bombs go off, and China is forced to invade to protect the local Chinese. Well, whatever it is, you know, then obviously that's the next step in these conflicts. But again, you know, like when we're a considerable distance from there now, and hopefully sanity would prevail before we got there. And then, you know, then there's the horrible scenario of great power conflict.
Mm.
Coming on the back of those, and obviously we're a long way from that, and hopefully we just never get there.
But I'd like to also just like point out, you know, we made the point right at the start as we thought that it was in China's best interest to backtrack quite quickly and to sort of take a slap on the wrist and let's go, and you know, take two or three steps backwards in order to sort of be able to drive their economy forward over the next 5-10 years. They haven't done that, and which means that this has been extended, and the longer they wait to do that, the worse the effect. And so it's the danger is they lock themselves into this position where they're like, right, you know, we should have gone back right at the start, but we're too late now, we're already pot committed, you know, I'm pushing this to the end. And that's where, yeah. That's
well, the more you arouse those nationalistic sentiments, you know, as a strongman leader, the more difficult it becomes to backtrack. Most definitely, you get painted into a political corner.
Mm.
It's easier in a democracy.
Yep.
To just
because you just get voted out and say it was the
well, you get voted out, or you just say, look, you know, I've changed my mind, or you can flip flop.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, like John Howard did it a million times. He'd drive it as far as he could, realize it wasn't popular, and change his mind.
Mm.
It's more difficult when you've based your entire regime around you being kind of an untouchable imperial force.
Absolute control.
and that's where Xi's problem now is as well, is because he's got absolute power, as close to absolute power as you want, he's also got all the blame. So it's very, you know, for him it's even more difficult because it's not a, you know, it's no longer, he's now the emperor for life. It's no longer the point of you could go, well,
this is someone else's problem, I'm out of here.
Exactly. or, you know, the party sort of goes, okay, that's somebody else's problem. Let's shift him out, shift somebody back in and reset everything.
Very true.
Yeah.
So we'll zoom across now to perhaps looking at the investment side of all these themes. Start with asset allocation.
So I might just tackle Forex and then hand it over.
Sure.
So at the moment, there are two extraordinary forces at work on the Australian dollar, both of them very extreme. In fact, three. One is that, you know, the Vale accident has created this sort of artificial shortage of iron ore. And, you know, so our terms of trade have gone completely nuts. I suspect if there was no Vale accident, iron ore would today be around 55, maybe 60. So it's probably double where it would be. I could be wrong on that. Maybe the impending Chinese stimulus would have held it up a bit better. But I think the trade war has gotten bad enough for people to actually have been pricing in more difficult growth. So anyway, that's some upthrust for the Australian dollar, as well as, you know, kind of the potential for Chinese domestic stimulus to keep pressure on that supply imbalance. On the other hand, we've got this negative yield spread to the US, which is getting worse because, you know, Australian growth is pretty screwed because of the housing bust. Mm-hmm. We think that will ease in 2020, but not imminently. And, you know, it's going to take at least 2 rate cuts, if not 4. I think it's still odds on that we're going to get more than the market's currently pricing in,
yep,
despite APRA. And so, you know, those two forces kind of more or less cancel each other out, or you have this tension between the two that almost ends up neutral. But when you add the trade war to it, which is just this generic negativity around China and China proxies, then that really tips the balance against the AUD. And part of that, of course, is the strong US dollar that we see continuing at least until markets break around sufficiently hard that the Fed is forced to move. So the first sort of input into the asset allocation is the Australian dollar is weak and getting weaker.
Okay, sure thing.
Just
relating that into the investment point of view, if we're looking at our asset allocation, so
it means we're more likely to buy international assets.
Okay,
on that basis, the next step, the equities versus bonds, is more difficult. So mainly because of pricing. So the bonds in Australia have come in significantly. We still think they have further to fall, but mm-hmm. they have come in a long way quite quickly.
So when you say that the yields have fallen,
which has meant the price has gone up.
Yep.
Yep. So that's been a great trade. Equities have, but at the same time, equities have run up quite hard as well. So equities, bonds are pricing in things being quite poor economically.
Mm.
Equities are pricing in things being quite good economically.
That's interesting.
And so we've got this complete disconnect between the two. And so
some of that is just the equity risk premium, though. I mean, once your yields fall so far.
Yeah, you can justify having...
You get this dash for trash into anything with a yield.
Yes.
And so the banks, for instance, are now trading on like forward multiples of 15 as they're struggling through the greatest housing bust, you know, probably since the 1890s, because they've, you know, got these crazy divvies, which, if you look at them in terms of, or relative to the bond rate, are just off the chart.
Mm, mm.
And so people are paying over the odds just to get the divvy.
Yeah. Yeah, so the question there is comes down to saying, well, you know, there are equities we'd like to buy, given how expensive bonds are, but the flip side is the equities are so expensive that and pricing in, you know, quite a benign outcome to the whole scenario that you have to sort of... economically, you'd like to say, fundamentally, you'd like to say, well, now's the time to be, you know, well underweight equities and well overweight bonds. But if the pricing's been flipped around and the bond trade is not as attractive as it was, then it sort of means you've got to pull back a little bit on that. And so we've been actually sitting in a little bit of cash for maybe a month now, just sort of looking for a market pullback to
dive in
to look where we can sort of allocate,
and okay.
whether it be, you know, if things start looking better and economically things start looking better and we see the bond yields start to rise again, then we'll probably be loading more into some of those.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side is if you see some accidents and equities start to price some of this in.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the moment it is a very distinct that you're seeing equities not pricing in the trade war and bonds pricing it in.
Mm, it is, yeah. International versus Australia as well.
Yeah, so that's where, certainly on that side, we're leaning more towards international. Having said that, though, post the election, the prospects for Australia over the short term have improved.
Mm.
Longer term, we still think we think there's a much greater chance now of secular stagflation and inflation rates staying much lower for longer, because if we just keep doing the same thing we've been doing for the last sort of 5-10 years, then that secular stagnation is going to keep going along, and the low wage growth and all that stuff is going to play out. But the immediate risk of a Labor government putting up their negative gearing and seeing house prices fall back further and negative sort of tail risks on that front in the short term have sort of faded away. The question is now, you know, if will growth hold up enough or not hold up enough, and there's still I would say a vulnerable area, but it's, and we're going to jump in more detail next week and go into housing.
Yep.
But yeah, it certainly looks at the next 6 to 12 months that they're things look a lot better under a coalition government for the housing market than what they would have under a Labor government.
Okay. I think you can say the same, roughly the same calculus applies to our external environment too, where the Vale accident especially, but to some extent Chinese stimulus to offset the trade war makes the short term look okay. But the longer the trade war goes and develops more into a containment of the Chinese economy, the worse the Australian outlook gets.
Yes.
For the longer term, because you'll simply see secular stagnation overtake China quicker as well. Because it will never make that leap to higher value-added added growth.
Just before we jump across to the stock selection, I've just another question that popped in here. Just with the housing bust, and I know we're going to cover off in this in more detail next week, but just with the housing bust, with the precarious economic backdrop, do you think that 4 rate cuts, more easing in credit standards and potential QE is enough to stabilise the falls?
I do in the short term, yeah. Don't forget you've got fiscal coming in as well, directly into housing. ScoMo's already said he will uncap his first home buyer guarantee. And it's effectively unlimited. There will be more fiscal spending as well. You can see various pressures coming to bear on some of the state governments already, especially in Victoria, to spend more.
APRA's already caved on its...
APRA's cave is staggering, but there it is. We actually did expect it in our own sort of horribly cynical way. That it happened, in January, APRA said its interest rate buffer was permanent in black capitals. And here we are in May, and it's gone.
It's disappeared.
It's gone. So what can you say is going to happen by December?
Fair point.
We think that the cavalry is riding in and will basically keep coming.
And that is the assumption as well. Is that's one of the key assumptions, is saying if there's more things you can keep throwing at the housing market and there's more ways you can keep transferring money from the government into places to convince people to leverage up more and buy more houses. And it appears as if the government doesn't have a philosophical problem with doing that.
Now, with that said, we don't see any new boom or anything.
No.
Just enough to stabilise and maybe grind prices a bit higher, but and longer term, as these stagnation scenarios transpire in China and here, the way that really plays out in wages and incomes for both countries, and as that transpires and intensifies over through the 2020s, then housing is going to be in trouble again.
And it's a part, I think, over a longer period of time we're expecting real returns to be quite poor. If that means we throw a bunch of resources at it to hold the housing market up for a few years and then it can just go sideways, we get out of the trouble and it can just go sideways. But if they get the calculus wrong and it does go for a tumble again. But I think there's certainly more downside risk than what there is upside risk. But as you said, the first few days of the new government has
been very active on the housing front.
Certainly indicated that yes, it's willing to do whatever it takes to keep the housing market from falling away, because it's promised that house prices will be higher under a coalition government than what it would under a Labor government. So now it needs to make good on that promise.
So the long tail risk for housing is still there, but it's more now, I would say, external than internal, and that's really what you have to worry about, the trade war really. If these trade war or economic war scenarios really get going and we get a global shock, as we've discussed through oil or falling international earnings for S&P firms tipping back into the US share market, and some kind of, big correction leading to, a global shock, then, you've got to ask yourself, given how precarious the Australian housing market is today, whether we'd really be pushing on a string. I think we probably would be.
Yeah, and the other final thing that we don't know for sure, which is more, which is on the negative side as well, is that at the moment we've got the break on, which is the change in lending standards.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got one foot on the brake, and now we're tossing the other foot onto the accelerator. At the moment, we think they're sort of going to balance out.
Yep.
But we're not sure.
Mm.
Like, that brake is pretty strong,
and
maybe we don't. Maybe they don't throw enough at it, or it gets to a certain stage where I don't think you've broken the Australian, the psyche of the Australian property investor. I think is still, this is a chance to buy again, and I'm waiting for my chance to throw as much in as I can, but you just need to be careful that we're not certain. There's not certain the outcome in terms of this, and we're still, the next 6 months is going to be sort of quite a crucial period in trying to work out, you know, is that break overcoming the foot on the accelerator, or is it the other way around?
All of ScoMo's props that he's putting up at the moment.
Well, we're gonna see 6 months of rising unemployment first, so it'll be dicey.
Yep. Okay, well, very good. Thanks for that, James. A full answer there, and I'm sure we'll have about an hour of answering next week as well on the topic. So we'll jump across into stock selection. So we've got a series of sectors here. How are these themes, the trade war themes, going to impact these stock selection, Damo?
Just in interest of time, I'll run relatively quickly through this. I might, because I have run through these before in the past. I think most of them sort of probably come back to a relatively simple one. The tech sector is one of the more interesting ones, and the tech sector's got lots of different components to it. Some of it, this is quite a bit positive in terms of the longer term. So the semiconductor part in particular, it's quite positive in terms of the longer term outlook for that sector, where the stocks within that sector are basically losing what could have been their biggest competitors in China, and so quite positive on the longer term outlook. The negative side for that sector is that's a very cyclical sector. It very much depends upon world growth, and world growth isn't looking good.
Mm.
So it's that's that part of the tech sector is we think it's a longer term gainer. We've got some of it because it's still quite cheap. We sort of tipped out over the last few months as it ran up.
Yep.
A stock like Apple is one of the most interesting ones, and that's where there's a lot of issues sort of bouncing around. So on one hand, they've got the same benefit. They've just lost one of their biggest competitors in terms of Huawei or ZTE or one of these guys that could have easily rise up and have competitive phones to Apple. So they've lost a competitor at one side. On the flip side, they've probably lost a lot of growth prospects in China.
Mm.
And at worst, maybe China pulls, and you do see Apple as a ban or something like that.
Yep.
I think that's highly unlikely, because I think Apple obviously does a lot of manufacturing in China, so they like Apple in China manufacturing their stuff.
Yep.
And so to put a ban on a company for selling their goods in a country where they're one of the largest manufacturers, I think would be devastating for other companies that were either
You've got the whole
manufacturing
supply chain
there. All those things we spoke about before, just turn around and go, well, just a minute, that happened to Apple. What's stopping it? And they're the biggest or third biggest, depending on what day you measure, company in the world.
Mm.
What about poor little me producing stuff there? Man, I'll be toast.
Yep.
So, I don't think that would be the case, but I do think some of the growth prospects in terms of it being negative on by the...
It mustn't be forgotten that the Chinese are very good at doing things surreptitiously as well. When I say the Chinese, I mean the Communist Party, as we were discussing before, just the stoking of national sentiment.
Mm.
Yes.
And what can appear to be grassroots boycotts of products can be seeded.
Yes.
So you can actually go that way without necessarily the formal blowbacks.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so now you've got to say, okay, well, if they've lost most of their growth prospects and probably see a bit of that happen, and so you're probably going to lose sales in China, but you've lost some of your possible major competitors in the rest of the world, which one, how does that weigh out in terms of this? So there's a lot of, and sector by sector and company by company, they're all facing sort of similar stories. So so the ones I spoke about before, some of those tech sectors don't really have don't have the same issues in terms of what they're selling in China versus offshore. And whereas something like a Google or a Facebook, they're already locked out of China, so there's no issues for them. And there's the chance of a Baidu or someone like that expanding, or Tencent expanding into to pick up more countries and more users is now sort of swept away. So there's some stocks are very much benefiting, other ones are losing, and there's some like Apple in between where it's sort of saying, well, it's going to lose on one hand and gain on the other, and where does it weigh out? So I do think there are opportunities in that tech sector, and especially as I do think there's a fundamental change in the way China will be looked at in terms of being part of the supply chain.
So John, just on that note, and obviously Apple's a big stock, but is there a strategy in looking for, say, tech companies, as you explained before, like say something like a Facebook or a Google, where it's just all positive that these things, you know, is there a strategy in just saying, all right, I'm just going to delete out China exposure and therefore I should be okay?
Absolutely, but it has to be at the right price. I mean, and I think Google and Facebook are a little bit different in that while there are big Chinese competitors that could potentially have stepped in, it wasn't looking likely.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Yep. And so, but there are other areas where, and Huawei is probably your key example where it did look like it was producing phones that were getting better and better quality, and they were bridging the gap and becoming
And just jumping across just quickly on the tech one with the micro processing and those sort of I know that's been a bit of a favourite Nucleus Wealth in the past. Has that sort of had a resurgence in interest now that everyone's moved away from the bugged motherboards and all the rest of it?
Yeah, I mean I think I could spend another hour on that whole sector because that's
another show in it for us.
Yeah, that's the issue with that sector is it's extremely cheap.
Yep.
And it's extremely cheap because everyone's expecting prices to get smashed again over the next little while, and we're expecting prices to come down. Everyone's expecting, they have come down a fair bit, but the question is how low they go and whether there's been a lot of consolidation in the sector. Now you've got the trade war stuff going on. There's a myriad of things that sort of go into that equation.
Okay. Sure.
More than I can deal with in the next 5 minutes. Other stocks, so defense stocks, we think globally, you know, they'll pick up. In terms of both Europe and US spending more on defense. Exporters globally, depending upon what you're in, but if you're competing with China, and especially if you're selling products into the US, that's positive for you, depending upon which country it's from. But oil and gas, we spoke a fair bit about before. The CapEx spend, if people who are in that whole CapEx area, we do think as supply chains shift out of China, you're going to need that CapEx spend, whether it's in the US or Mexico or...
So when you say CapEx is like a factory builder or someone that outfits things and general construction, perhaps?
Exactly. Yep. Not as much. There's two parts to that. One is the people who are supplying to the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. So using that tech space as well. There's a bunch of companies that are quite large that we hold in our portfolio, and they produce the machines that produce the
shovel makers.
Exactly. And so some of those ones, okay, I need to diversify my supply chain. I've got one in Taiwan, I've got one in China, and I've got one, I need to build another one in the US or Mexico.
Yep.
Whatever. Okay, they're going to benefit from, there'll be duplicated things from that.
Okay.
The other side is the CapEx is, if we are seeing that twin Keynesian booms tick along where China starts spending a lot of money on keeps spending more and tries to spend more, and we also see in the US, there's $2 trillion package that's looking at, whether or not it gets up or not, or when it gets up, but there's almost certainly, if the trade war keeps going the way it's going, there'll need to be some fiscal spend from both parties, and so companies that will benefit from that.
Okay, sure.
And we ran through a fair bit in resources with David's one.
Yeah, no worries. Okay, and just finishing up on portfolio changes, so snapshot of today, how is all these themes being reflected through in what we're doing right now?
Yeah, so we, as markets rose sort of through the start of the year, we pulled back a lot of our cash, and we're still trying to find the stocks we want to buy with it. We don't think the markets have yet reflected what's happening, and so we're waiting for things to for stocks in the right areas to come back. There's a few things we're nibbling at the moment, but yeah, we're largely got our target list, going through working out what the exposures are, where it's coming from, and trying to work out where we get to, because obviously there's a lot of different possibilities. The main thing I'd leave people with in terms of running their own portfolios is working out what's priced into your stock. So there's a fundamental outlook of saying, you know, what you think's going to happen, but if the stock's already priced all the good into that,
yep,
and none of the bad, then you need to, well, let's move on to another stock where you know, maybe the fundamental outlook isn't as good, but it's just not priced into the stock at all.
Okay, yeah, sure. One of the beauties of having the biggest 1,600 companies in the world to choose from, Damien, so that's quite handy, and a literal war chest as well, trade war chest of cash ready to go. Thanks for that, fellas. So we'll jump across to what's coming up next week. So on Thursday, the 30th of May, same bat time, same bat channel, 12:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, we're going to be looking at the ScoMo housing boom or bust. So obviously with our recent election results, some would say a surprise, for others not so, how this is going to be reflected into what we thought for or what many people thought for a while there was going to be a fait accompli with the housing bust. Is there going to be sufficient support, as we covered off a little bit today, to keep the housing boom rolling on? So jump across to the Nucleus Wealth live webinar page. As always, we shoot these live, so you can drop in some questions. Thanks very much to everybody who posted some questions and comments in there today, and we look forward to catching you at the next one. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.